probably about 40-50% of cancers are preventable by us changing our lifestyle, or the way that we eat, or how we exercise, or the environment that we live in.
Welcome to the Flippin' Health Podcast, where we turn medicine on its head, flip it upside down, shake it all about, and see what comes out. We're going to challenge convention and change medicine for the better.
Hello, I'm Grant Schofield.
And I'm George Henderson.
Welcome to the
Flippin' Health Podcast.
Grant Schofield here with Richard Babor. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Grant.
Thanks. Who are you and what do you do?
I'm an upper gastrointestinal and weight loss surgeon at Counties Monaco DHB. And I've been doing that for the last 10 years. I'm also a part-time TV presenter, and we've recently collaborated, Grant, on a show that we made called How Not to Get Cancer, and had quite a good little segment on exercise for cancer prevention.
Love the show.
Thanks.
I particularly love that you cut me well, so I looked much better than I am in real life.
Mm.
So we'll talk about that coming a bit later, but what I'm inquisitive about is when you're a surgeon, like, there's a whole world that someone like me looks at half in awe and half just scared of. Imagine what that would be like. Yeah, well, not that I want that surgery, but even just having to do that to someone, you're in the gowns, you're scrubbed, you've got the machines, you've got blood vessels and scalpels. What does a day look like?
So I do upper gastrointestinal surgery, and that's mainly surgery on the esophagus, stomach and pancreas, sometimes a small bowel. And generally it's quite complex surgery technically, so some of the operations that I do might take all day, just one patient. And so when I have a case like that, it's usually fairly, my schedule's fairly simple. I've got one case on my list, but we usually start at 8 o'clock in the morning. And often there's complex anesthetic kind of preliminary stuff. And so I don't really get started till 9:30 or 10. It's taken me a long time to train to get to this kind of level of complexity of surgery. And so, like, it's very hard to explain it to people who don't have like a medical background or, you know, some idea of anatomy or physiology or surgery. And most of the time, I'm not doing surgery. In fact, it's another thing. So like, a lot of surgery is not actually operating. I operate maybe 2 days a week, maybe 1.5 days a week most times. And the rest of the time I'm doing stuff like ward rounds or teaching registrars, or teaching medical students, or doing administrative work, or going to meetings and planning stuff and seeing patients in clinic, or thinking about what I'm going to do to a patient in terms of the surgery that they need or tests that they need.
Okay, but basically it all revolves around thinking about surgery.
Pretty much, that's my job.
Or post-surgery, or training others and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's the sharp end of my job, is actually operating. Yep. And it's probably the bit that's sort of the most challenging. Yep.
So there's got to still be a first time you actually cut a person open.
Oh, yeah, there is.
Does that stick in your mind?
Well, kind of. You know, like, I remember, and I hear what you're saying about that sort of feeling of dread, because I do remember when I first started training in surgery, and I've been through medical school and done my kind of house surgeon jobs, and, you know, we're mainly doing paperwork and listening to people's chests with a stethoscope and stuff. And then you come to this part maybe 2 or 3 years in being a doctor where you might for the very first time be expected to take someone's appendix out, right?
Yep.
And actually taking that knife and making an incision into another person is quite a weird sort of sensation
and a responsibility. Like, where are you feeling with that? What are you even thinking?
Well, yeah, because I mean, this is a living, breathing person.
That's for some reason Richard has decided that his cell phone sound is the sound of a loud animal.
It's a humpback whale.
Oh, humpback whale. Yeah. I wondered what that was. And what brought that on?
I just like whales. I like the, and humpbacks are kind of freaky whales, aren't they?
Yeah, that loud sort of groaning noise. Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. I didn't even know there was such a ringtone. Folks, you can look that up. The humpback whale.
But now I get, you know, like, that sensation is actually I get that different ways now as well. Like, there's this real feeling of dread that I get sometimes when I approach a difficult case where I know there's a tumour that I have to resect and it's close to some vital structures like the portal vein or the hepatic artery.
There's actually a chance of something going wrong here.
Yeah. And this person is kind of completely dependent on me, I guess, actually. And it usually is just me because the registrar or training surgeon that's helping me oftentimes is in a little world of their own.
Yeah, right.
And ultimately, it is my responsibility. Yeah, sometimes we get into some quite scary territory where literally someone's life might be in my hands and we might be millimetres away from some critical structures.
Yeah. On the other hand, you've got the ability to actually really help these people.
Well, that's right. That's why we do it. I mean, the kind of cancers that I deal with are actually quite bad cancers. They often have quite a bad prognosis. And even if you do surgery on people, often the risk of recurrence is quite high. But it's not always that way. And actually, you know, particularly in young patients with curable disease, I think that's a really satisfying area that I get a lot of gratification from.
How do you even decide that you're going to go to medical school and be a surgeon? How does that even happen?
Well, I kind of feel, it wasn't any sort of driving kind of force that I always knew that I wanted to be a doctor, etc. And I'm not one of these people who's, I don't know, has a kind of a faith-based motivation for that kind of thing, which is quite common.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was good at science and maths and stuff at school, so that was one thing. And my mum's from a family of doctors, and she was quite keen on the idea, and I didn't really have any other strong thing drive me. And yeah. So, you know, I kind of agreed to do that and gave it a try, and actually turned out that it was like really interesting. The university course was interesting, and so I kept on with it, and then suddenly 6 years later you kind of pop out the other end, you know. And as my education in medicine and career have progressed, I've found it progressively more interesting and more challenging, and so I guess that's what's kept me in it. And also that other aspect that I just touched on with you is that, you know, it is gratifying to be able to help people. And it's sort of when they're in a quite a desperate tight corner in their lives, and to be able to extract a good outcome out of that is,
that's cool,
very satisfying. Yeah.
And so then
which doesn't always happen, by the way. And so that's one of the difficult aspects of it, because sometimes things go wrong and things don't go right, and people have disease that can't be cured and they get complications or progression and that sort of stuff. And so there's that aspect of it that is also challenging and tricky.
And do you think surgery will be radically different in, you know, 100, 200 years' time? We're going to look back at this surgery and go, wow, how come there wasn't the computer doing it or something?
Well, probably.
Yeah.
Probably, like many things. As you know yourself, the technology seems to be progressing at an exponential rate. So, you know, if you look back on surgery that was done even 30, 40, 50 years ago, some of those things are kind of obsolete. Some things have stayed very true and useful. You know, like for many cancers, for example, surgery is still the treatment.
Yep.
It is the most effective thing that you can do for someone. So chemotherapy for a lot of tumors hasn't progressed very much, you know, and these people are throwing billions of dollars at research into all kinds of immunotherapies and research on drugs, and progress in that area has been really slow. But you know, the old surgical saying of you need cold steel to heal is...
I wasn't aware of that saying, but yeah, there we go.
it remains remarkably kind of constant over that time. So who knows? Probably, you know, we still use scalpels today, but there's a lot of other instruments that are more modern that we use. People use all sorts of things, robots and lasers and, you know, argon beam coagulators and you name it. And
is it more of a sort of microvasculature operating procedures that you probably
don't get involved with? I don't really do a lot of that stuff myself.
But,
I mean,
but people do.
But people do. Probably the thing that's influenced, that's changed most in my career has been a change to laparoscopic surgery, which is keyhole surgery. Yeah. So most of the things that were done by open surgery when I started training to do as a surgeon, a lot of those things are now done by keyhole surgery, and that's much better for patients.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of progression and technology in those lines. So kind of even smaller incisions or using robots to control the laparoscopic instruments, that's routinely done. They've got a robot here in the North Shore that's used for urology surgery mainly. Lots of other stuff like imaging techniques, you know, like 3D surgery, because you know normally at the moment we do laparoscopy, it's on a 2D screen.
Yep.
3D is coming into use more and more and more.
Right, so it really guides your
use
of the
instrument.
Well,
you get a bit of spatial kind of orientation inside someone's abdomen or wherever you're operating. And then there'll be other things that will come into play probably in the next few years, like superimposing images onto the surgical field. So you might have...
Oh, with glasses or something?
Yeah, you might have like glasses that allow you to see in 3D, and then on the screen it might have a superimposed three-dimensional image of where the tumour is that you're operating on and the kind of blood vessels around it, you know, lighting up, or so that you're kind of more aware of where you are in space when you're doing surgery. And there's all sorts of little kind of steps in endoscopic surgery, so more and more things are being done rather than through incisions in the abdomen, but like with a telescope going down into the gut. And
you can operate using that from there.
I don't do that particularly specifically myself, but it is a technology that's evolved a lot in the last 10 years. And so some of the things that used to be commonly done by surgery through an incision can now be done through an endoscope without making any incisions in the patient. It's just down through the mouth and down the esophagus. And
cool. Okay, let's talk about cancer specifically now.
Sure.
And probably more about how not to get cancer, which is the show that you led very well. There's also, my first question about that is, as part of that, when you're operating, going, hey, some of these tumours people never needed to get in the first place. Do you ever think that when you're operating?
No, not really. Not in the heat of the operation. Yep. Often I'm just kind of focused on the sort of progression and the steps of the surgery and doing that safely. But it is something that comes up in clinic quite a lot. And not so much for me, because I kind of have this... I have a sense of why people get cancer, which is based in science and statistics and, you know, epidemiology. But patients ask that question, and that's part of what motivated me to collaborate on this show, because it's not uncommon for people to come into clinic and often tell them, look, you've got stomach cancer. And I say, well, why did I get stomach cancer? What did I do to get this? I'm only 57, whatever it is. And it's a question that challenges people who have cancer.
Yeah. And that was confronting, because there was some controversy around the name of the show, How Not to Get Cancer, because people felt that that was unfairly blaming people who did have cancer for that partially being their fault. What do you make of that?
Oh, yeah, well, there's a lot of things to say about that kind of mini controversy. I mean, firstly, I think that it did seem to me that a lot of that stuff came up before people had watched the show.
Yeah.
So the main sort of critic of that name who appeared on television hadn't watched the show.
You get criticism.
And within the first kind of 2 minutes of the beginning of the show, you know, I say nobody's to blame for getting cancer.
That's right. I mean, you did say that. But it is society is to blame.
Well, there are lots of factors that play into that, right? You know, like, I mean, say, if you smoke and you get lung cancer, then, you know, I guess you can look at that. I mean, you know, if you're brought up in China and in a household where 9 out of 10 people smoke, well, you know, that's a different sort of a scenario, but it is a thing that we can, it is a behavior and it is an influence on the risk of cancer that we can, you know, change and influence individually. I know for sure that the biggest risk factor, and we talked about this briefly before, for cancer is age, right? Yep. So the older your population, the more likely you are to get, the older you are, the more likely you are to get cancer, and you can't stop that. You can't make yourself younger.
There's going to be not zero cancer in society as well.
There's probably never going to be zero cancer. There's all sorts of cancers that just random things, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know, childhood lymphomas and leukemias, and you know, cancers in very young people who people can, and this is part of the criticism that came out of it, was that, you know, there were a lot of responses to the TVNZ website on the thing. It was like, well, this is really offensive and disgusting. You're blaming people for getting cancer. My wife never drank, never smoked. She exercised every day, only ate vegetables. She's still got breast cancer and it's stage four. And, you know, you're making her feel bad. Well, there are going to be cancers.
That can happen.
That's a statistical thing. But, you know, the World Health Organization and the International Agency for Research on Cancer and all of these kind of huge institutions that do a lot of research into cancer, the epidemiology of cancer, estimate that probably about 40-50% of cancers are preventable by us changing our lifestyle or the way that we eat or the or how we exercise or the environment that we live in, right? You know, so like one of the real stark examples of that is the little segment that we did on HPV and its relationship to cervical cancer.
Yep.
And that is clearly, you know, and cervical cancer makes up a small proportion of cancers. And it's maybe, I don't know, 1 or 2%.
But if you've got it, it's still a serious cancer if you've got it, right?
It's a serious cancer, it can kill you, right?
Yep.
And if you have an HPV vaccination, you won't get it.
Right.
Right.
Simple as that.
So it's just simple. And so if we had like 100% take up, or probably even less than 100% take up, because it'll eradicate the virus from the population, even if not everybody's vaccinated, right?
Yeah.
If we did that, then we could eradicate cervical cancer.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's not a bad message to send, is it?
Yeah. So that's a good way to not get cancer.
Yeah.
And then, but then there's other things, right? So if you don't inhale tobacco smoke into your lungs, you reduce your chance of
So 19 out of 20 lung cancers are caused by tobacco.
Yeah.
So some people will still get lung cancer.
Yeah. Right? But 1/20th of what currently get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then we move to less certain things like
diet.
Or diet. So we know if the glucose in your blood is high for your whole life and your insulin and your insulin like growth factor are higher, then you've got an increased risk of some mainly hormonal cancers.
Mm.
And then so you go, well, yeah, how do you manage that? We have to eat. We don't have to smoke. So, it gets more complicated.
Those things, and you know, whatever you do, there will always be a risk, right? And you can't live a perfect life in terms of cancer prevention and expect not to get cancer. But what you can do is reduce your risk.
Yeah.
And one of the really nice things about all of the things that reduce your risk of cancer is that they're generally good for all the other aspects
too,
like your cardiovascular kind of fitness and avoiding cardiovascular events and avoiding the risk of dementia and neurodegenerative diseases. So it's a very happy story if you can think about how you apply those things in your life. Yep. You know, like, so we went to Japan and Okinawa. And Okinawa is a bit of a sort of a two-sided coin because people live, the older generation of Okinawans live a really, really long time.
Yep.
You know, the guy that we interviewed there, Dr. Suzuki, he's got, you can see in the interview, he's got these files, he's got about 3,500 files on people who lived to 100 years old.
Wow.
It's a funny story. Like, he got sent down there from Tokyo, he's not an Okinawan himself, as the first cardiologist to set up in the hospital, and he's like, there's no work to do here because nobody's got any cardiovascular disease and they're all living to 100 years old.
Yep.
What's going on?
Right? Yep.
And what was remarkable about that to me is that they, the guys there, they live a long time. But, you know, and I kind of thought, if I live to 80 or 90, I'm going to get prostate cancer.
Yeah.
You know, because that's pretty much the story in the West. Sooner or later, your PSA starts to creep up.
Yeah.
And you have to go to your doctor and get the finger up the back passage, and next minute you've
getting a prostatectomy, and away you go, yeah,
all that. And then, and because it's seemed to me kind of inevitably related to age,
yep.
But actually, their risk of cancer, of prostate cancer, in that older generation of men is really low,
right,
compared to Western populations,
yep.
And it's probably to do with their diet. All the other factors that come into play in those so-called blue zones, yep. Like, you know, sense of community, a sense of, yep, purpose.
It's not going to affect your chance of prostate cancer.
Well, yeah, they might, because what those things do is hold together those other aspects of lifestyle, which are, you know, diet.
Yeah.
Diet and activity predominantly,
yeah.
I would think. And so they're very active people. They never, yeah, stop working. As, yeah, the concept of retirement is not, they don't understand that at all, because they just expect to work.
Yeah, which is a really interesting way that we think about life very differently than that in the Western world.
Yeah, you kind of aspire to retire,
yeah.
And they aspire to kind of continue to work and stay engaged in their families and communities until they shuffle off, right?
Yep.
And they have this really predominantly vegetable diet,
yep,
and it's really rich in soy, which,
yep,
probably has an influence on those hormonal cancers that,
yep,
you know, that we run into all the time, particularly in Western cultures,
yep,
colon cancer, yep, breast cancer, prostate cancer, all of those things. And, you know, it's very low rates. And so I thought, well, you know, that actually is the proof of the pudding, right?
Yep.
And if we all kind of lived a little bit more like that,
yep,
then we would have lower rates of prostate cancer. It wouldn't be zero. It's not zero, yep, in Okinawa. And so, like I said to one of the people that kind of interviewed me about this criticism of the name of the show, you kind of, when you're trying to do something to help or creative, yep, you know, and you're actually trying to get people to engage in it,
yep,
you do have to kind of
be provocative.
Be a little bit provocative, but also cut corners to get across, you know. We were talking about this just before about how you can never get an epidemiologist to say something black and white.
Yeah,
it's always, oh, is a correlation and blah, the p-value and all this sort of stuff. Well, you know, and I said to this interviewer, what should we call the show then? How to statistically reduce your risk of getting cancer?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, no one.
Who's going to watch that? It'll,
yeah,
get like buried at 6:30 on Sunday morning, and people think it's a science show, you know.
Yeah.
And we've really deliberately tried to stay away from that kind of overly sciencey or cerebral thing to make it. This is a tricky topic in,
yeah,
itself. It's a dark topic, and,
yeah,
and to get people to engage with it, then I think you have to include some lightness and levity and even,
yeah,
a little bit of humour,
yeah,
and a bit of humanness in it,
yeah,
to get people to stay engaged and not just change channel or switch off, you know. And it's the other thing, you know, like about the sort of scariness of it is that kind of necessarily there's going to be people who react in an emotional way to,
yeah,
a show like this,
yeah,
right?
Why are people so much more scared of cancer than, say, something equally as fatal as, like, ischemic heart disease?
I think that, you know, even in, this is kind of speaks to the next show that we are going to do, and I don't know if I can actually mention it, but everyone's got this idea, right? I mean, many people, not everybody, but, you know, like, it's really common for people to say, oh, you know, I just want to live till I'm 85, and then just die in my sleep peacefully, and, you know,
yeah,
and this, well, the idea.
Well, I was thinking more heroically, to be honest, but still.
And so, you know, that people have this idea that they're going to live fit, healthy, active, engaged lives right up until the last kind of night of their life,
yeah,
and then sort of drop dead quietly in their sleep.
Yeah.
And cardiovascular disease kind of fits in a little bit with that. You know, have a massive stroke and
that's the,
yeah,
end of it.
And that's the end of it. And,
yeah,
you never have to kind of go through this period of time where you are sick or disabled.
Or death's hanging over you.
Death's hanging over you.
Yeah.
You're just kind of independent and happy,
yeah,
for your whole life, and then it stops suddenly.
Yeah.
And I think people kind of think, oh, yeah, well, if I die of a heart attack, I'll be happy with that. You know?
Yeah.
But dying of cancer raises a whole lot of other issues, you know, like battling with it, the prospect of pain, the prospect of losing independence, the prospect of becoming a burden to people, you know, in your community or your family around you having to have lots of invasive and unpleasant medical interventions.
The side effects of those interventions.
And the side effects of all those kinds of things. And so that's, I think, where the fear comes in. And I think many people have personal experience of that, you know. Like I have patients, they go, and I say to them, this, like, the treatment for this cancer is chemotherapy followed by surgery followed by chemotherapy. And they go, no, I'm not having chemo.
Yeah.
My cousin had chemo. It was horrific.
Yeah.
You know. And so there is a sort of fear in that it's a complicated, grueling, long way to suffer and then go out, which is not actually true in most cases. But
so what do you make of this? My dad has at the moment has metastatic prostate cancer, and he met with a similar fellow, just his son was a friend of mine who had a similar condition, and they met just only a few months ago. And this fellow was, dad was just about to do some chemo, and this guy was recommended to do some chemo. He said, no, I'm not doing chemo, I don't want my hair to fall out. And I just was talking to dad the other day, and dad's come through his chemo, he's doing quite well, and this fellow's died. And so, you know, we sort of said, well, yeah, that's unfortunate, because he's not going to be worrying about his hair now. And why do people choose that? How do you make that decision?
Well, you know, I well, firstly, hair is important to people, right?
Yeah.
and I know this because, like, for example, in weight loss surgery, one of the side effects of losing weight rapidly is that you get some hair loss. And quite, you know, in weight loss surgery, people might lose 40 kilos over a period of 9 or 12 months, or even more, 50 kilos perhaps. And there's always a bit of weight loss, hair loss that's associated with that. And it's remarkable how, if like I'm getting consent for someone to have weight loss surgery, then I'll say that they kind of go through this long list of things which happen at a very low frequency, but, you know, include things like death, leak, peritonitis, prolonged hospitalization, ICU admission, re-operation, bleeding,
goodness,
clots in the legs and lungs. You know, like these things can happen. They happen, I mean, it's actually very safe surgery, but, you know, no surgery's got zero risk to it. And I get to the end of this list and they'll go, yeah, but what about hair loss?
Yeah.
As if that is the most horrific.
Yeah, you've got a chance of dying in surgery, but they're more worried about the hair loss, yeah.
So, you know, people worry about their hair. And it's not for us to, I guess, decide what's important to people, right?
Yeah.
So someone, if it's really important for someone not to have hair loss, and it's important enough for them to not have chemo, I suspect with this man that you've mentioned that there might have been other things behind it, not just the hair loss. But, you know, like I have lots of people who, you know, chemotherapy is not that effective for a lot of the cancers that I see. And so when you get to the stage where I can't offer surgery and I say, look, I can send you on to someone who can give you palliative chemotherapy, which might give you a bit more time and reduce some of the symptoms that you have, some will just go, no, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Because I've got other things to do. I'd rather not be shuttling back and forth to hospital having injections of chemo, which makes me nauseous and stuff. Like, I'm kind of okay at the moment. I'm just going to get on with the things that I want to do and accept my fate.
And that's admirable in many ways, isn't it? That then hanging on to the last possible moment of your life, no matter what the quality, is that a decision that you see people making?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, I think people have a fear of death.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing. And I'm basically, biologically, your organisms, we're organisms like any other kind of animal that we'll try to survive.
Yeah.
You know, we'll keep fighting till the last breath,
yeah,
usually, whether you're drowning or whether you're fighting cancer or whether you're fighting an infection.
But there will be a last breath.
There will be a last breath for every single one of us, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, immortality is another thing that's possibly on the horizon. We were talking about technology before, yeah. I don't know, downloading your consciousness. You know, yeah. We might have cyborg Grant still running around the track
that's
200 years time.
Yeah, which is quite a scary thought, really.
Yeah, a cyborg version of you would be very scary.
Yeah. So, Richard, what's good about the health system?
I think we've got a very equitable and accessible health system. I think it's probably better than the sort of what's said to be the gold standard, like the NHS. You know, you don't need insurance in New Zealand to access most of the things that are available in any other kind of Western country. And I think we've got a pretty lean health system as well.
It's quite good value for money, isn't it? Especially compared to the US or something like that.
Yeah. The amount of money that we spend on it, I think we've got fairly modern approach, like especially in my area of cancer surgery. I think, you know, people get the same treatment here for esophagus cancer, pancreas cancer, that they would in any Western country around the world, and probably of a fairly high standard. Yeah. You know,
and break your leg.
Break your leg, it's fixed. You have a heart attack, you'll get a stent. All those kinds of things happen regularly in public.
And quickly.
And usually in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and what's not working as well as it could?
So I think there's a degree of unevenness of access to the health system, and that's partly for cultural and socioeconomic reasons, partly because we've got a population that's quite split between urban and rural centres. I think the health outcomes for Māori and Pacific Island populations are much worse than they are for European populations, and that's an area that we do poorly in.
Well, that actually means quite a bit in the end. Like a Māori male living to just 60 or around there, and you and me maybe going to somewhere into a late 70s, early 80s. That's a lot of time to not be with your grandkids and
It's a being huge part of your family. It's a discrepancy between the life expectancy of the Māori and non-Māori people in New Zealand that needs to be addressed. And I mean, to be fair, it's not entirely the health system that's responsible for that. It's the general socioeconomic conditions and inequities
that
underlie it.
Yeah. What else?
Prevention, I think we do poorly. You know, and it's borne out by this, you know, that very little, currently there's a lot of talk about kind of a national cancer strategy.
Yeah.
And there's very little talk about prevention.
Yeah.
Obesity. Yeah. It's a massive problem. Yeah. Right? It's just going to, the potential to over, and it's already overwhelming our health systems. And there's been a lot of talk about this just very recently. And our DHB and the media is very interested in that as well. And that so much of the resources are going to go to looking after people who have, you know, who weigh 150, 160, 170 kilos, that it's mind-boggling how much of that resource it's going to suck in. Yeah. And there doesn't seem to be a coordinated approach to preventing obesity.
So what if we invested 10% of our health budget, which would be nearly $2 billion, on preventing stuff, then the trouble with that, of course, is we'd have to
take it away from somewhere else.
Absolutely. And that's the problem, is it?
I mean, invariably this comes down to politics.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, like say recently, there's this big fight over Pharmac not funding drugs for stage 4 cancer.
Yeah.
And so it's very politically powerful for people to get up and say, oh, I've got stage 4, you know, breast cancer.
And I've got a death sentence because the government's not supporting me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's very sad and tragic and difficult, you know, for those people. But those drugs can cost $100,000 a year.
And there's an opportunity cost to that because you could be spending it on other things.
That's like, I don't know, 8 obesity operations, which will prevent cancer too. I mean, I'm not saying don't give them drugs and do obesity surgery just because that's what I do. But I'm saying that, you know, or like shoring up the HPV vaccination program to make sure that the take up rate's more than 90%. You spend some of the money on that, then you save more than you.
Absolutely, the return would be much better. Yeah. The return on suffering would be much better. Yeah. And I'd be going, actually, let's spend it on stopping every school in the country getting sugar out of them, and you could
absolutely
do that, and
right.
that
would have a different thing. Yeah, absolutely right. You know, get the sugar out of schools, or you tax sugar.
Yeah,
but you see, that's the thing, is that politically, that's where the stumbling block is, because it's very hard. You know, I mean, the Cancer Society itself wheels these people out because it's such an emotional story.
Yeah.
It's not based on science or rational decision-making. It's based on the emotional fact that somebody's facing their mortality and they could possibly have this drug, which might give them a few, extra months, right?
Because you don't wake up in the morning going, thank God.
Who's going to be the person to say no to that?
Yeah, exactly. Politically, it's a disaster. And also, who wakes up in the morning going, thank God I haven't got cancer? Compared to the person who has got cancer, wakes up and goes, shit, I'm going to do everything in my power to live through this.
It's a very ephemeral thing. And so it's hard to tackle politically. Yeah. And it's just like obesity too. You know, like the food companies have unlimited marketing budgets. The alcohol companies, unlimited access and marketing budgets to promote their products. Yeah. And they're sort of culturally embedded.
Yeah.
And to make those kind of changes takes a lot of political vision and risk, you know, and people just not prepared to. No one's standing up and saying we should actually increase the price of alcohol, for example, which is proven over and over and over and over and over again to reduce the harm that it causes.
Yeah, and we still let the food companies in this country, and you know, mainly actually led also by Australia, help design the food labelling systems, like the health star rating. They're running amok.
I mean, you know, every time we say something like, "Oh, eat less meat," then the sheep and dairy board will come out and with some kind of, you know, propaganda to counter it, and they've got way more resources to promote that.
Yeah.
And it's a very hard nut to crack. There are approaches to this which are complicated, and you know, I'm not a public health specialist, thank goodness, because I think that we are absolutely thankless and difficult tasks. But you know, some of the work that's been done in other countries where, for example, really looking deep into the transparency of the relationships between industry and politicians and how that influence
works. Yeah, because that's been destructive, hasn't it?
Yeah. And actually legislating to expose those links so that they are actually transparent to people so that they can be broken down. You know, there's places in Finland where they've done, we managed to transform public health, bring down rates of cardiovascular disease, change the dietary kind of patterns of a whole population.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it's worked.
Yeah.
It can be done, but it takes the will to do it and tenacity and I don't know what it takes.
Yeah, you know? I guess the other side...
We don't seem to have it at the moment.
As the other side of the problem, the US is still really the leader of the free world, and their approach has been pretty much the exact opposite to this, where the lobbyists outnumber the public health people by 10 to 1.
Well, it's not just the lobbyists and outnumbering them 10 to 1, it's the budget that they outnumbered like by, I don't know, 10,000 to 1.
Yeah, right. I agree with that. Yeah.
And you know, someone was just, it's just related kind of humorous thing. Someone was saying to me today, they're reading this kind of humorous article, you know, The Onion, which is that sort of spoofy current affairs. They had a headline article there saying, new fad diet in the US. Stop eating for 5 minutes.
I actually saw another one on the internet this morning, which I dare people to Google, which this guy's calling the snake diet.
You only eat snakes.
No. He's saying that a snake eats a decent feed, then stops eating for ages.
Yeah.
He presented it in quite a... I dare people to Google it. It's not pretty. But it's just, again, the idea of fasting. So... what about yourself? We think about doctors, we think about them knowing a lot about health, therefore they'd be healthy.
Mm.
Is that true? Then what do you do?
I try to get good sleep. I think that's been influenced by some of the stuff that we've done on the show. I think it's really a critical thing.
Yep,
it's
like
a kind of a baseline thing where if you can get good sleep, then you feel like doing exercise, you eat better, all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Without that, it's really hard to, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. I notice if I miss a night's sleep because I have to get up and, you know, do something for work or whatever, then the next day I'll just eat pies. You know, and I don't seem to have any control of it. Like, I'm doing it, I know it's coming, and I go, I'm not having a pie today.
And then all of a sudden you're at the pie shop.
I'm like halfway through a pie.
Yeah, right.
It's bizarre.
Yeah.
The effect that it has on that sort of carb of, you know, the more craving for carbs and fat.
Yeah, the whole frontal lobe engagement and turning off.
Yeah, it's turned off.
Yeah.
And then I do exercise quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, and I run maybe 3-4 times a week. I do a little bit of yoga.
Yeah.
I surf when the conditions are favourable, which they haven't been for some time actually.
Yeah.
And I play tennis. I'm in the Point Shed Tennis Club, love that. So Wednesday night, I only sort of go to club night, but I really enjoy that.
But you've had a lifelong of
I've been active all my life.
Yeah, it's been something that's been part of your life and you've enjoyed it.
And probably I do more now than perhaps I have done in other times in my life, but I've kind of realised the importance of it to my well-being. I always start getting scratchy if I, for some reason, work so busy or am prevented by travel or whatever from exercising for 2 days. I start to feel kind of irritable. And
was that part of your issues when you're filming How Not to Get Cancer? Is that you were
irritable?
Well, no. that you had to travel. You guys travel a lot, didn't you?
That was the most punishing part of that whole experience, was the 3-week overseas shoot where we went to the United States, England, and Europe. And it was just...
Non-stop,
you know. It's horrific. You don't sleep very well because you're on the plane or you're in a different time zone constantly. It's just a series of airports, Ubers, hotels, 16-hour shoot days.
Trying to track down these people to get to say something sensible.
Yeah. And just feeling kind of exhausted most of the time, and then just doing it again and again and again and again because you've got this never-ending schedule to sleep. And it kind of comes out on the show, like it looks like people have said to me, he said, oh, you had a great trip, you know, like it looks like I'm swanning around Europe having a great time.
Venice or something, just, you know.
Yeah, but it's like absolutely tough, you know. And so sleeping, exercise, and I try to keep my diet in check, but probably that's the one that I struggle with the most because I like kind of fatty foods. I like croissants, pies. Yeah,
yeah. And
let the meat cake pie shop in Point Chev. Can I put a plug in for them?
Yeah, you quite like those. Yeah,
steak and mussel pies.
Oh, I didn't know there's such a thing as a steak and mussel pie. Oh, steak
I didn't know until they got one from there. I have them every time. They're great.
Oh, I might go there.
Point Chev next to the countdown.
Yeah, right.
Steak and mussel pies. I like love bacon and egg pies.
Yeah,
I love croissants.
Yeah.
I do like sweet things, you know, like I could probably easily, if I was completely off the leash, eat a packet of M&Ms, you know.
Yeah.
Peanuts, chocolate, all that. And so, what I have been influenced in a positive way by the show is that I've actually cut down on the amount of meat and ultra-processed food. I actually eat probably quite a lot more of that. And I kind of, you know, there's quite a few non-meat days in my
now. Yeah. Because the next question was going to be, what don't you do well? I think you've automatically covered that.
Mm.
Yeah. So when you're...
Alcohol probably. Yeah, alcohol. Drink at least that alcohol. But I mean, I quite enjoy a drink, but I mean, I probably don't drink as much as other people do, I think, I hope. But, you know, any amount of alcohol is probably not so great.
Yeah. I actually just try to challenge... which I thought was interesting, and with some friends of mine, so we ended up saying, well, for the next 3 weeks, we're not drinking anything.
3 weeks.
And I found it actually reasonably tough to start with, and I'd have cravings and these sorts of things which concern me.
Mm.
And then after a couple of weeks, they went away.
Mm.
One of the guys, I think, was more of a concern to me. Like, after 5 days, he's like, oh, gentlemen, I've fallen. I had to have a whiskey. I was like, oh. but what happened then is... I kept going for the 3 weeks. So I'll make it a month.
Yeah.
And then I thought, okay, well, I should just do the next month as well.
Yeah.
And then I thought I'd do the next month as well.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd do the next month as well. And now I'm up to 4 months.
Far out. You haven't had a drink at all for 4 months.
No, and I didn't think I would do that for any reason. And it's just sort of kept going. But I do like a drink, especially these low-carb beers and stuff. But... it's just, I felt so much better. My sleep has been so much better.
Mm.
And mainly because, you know, when you drink, you have to get from the night to go to the toilet, and that disrupts my sleep.
Mm.
So I felt astonishingly better.
Yeah, no, it's just reading an article in The Guardian about that about a week or two ago about someone who's given up alcohol and found it to be so beneficial that they don't ever want to go back to it.
Yeah.
I think it's quite hard to maintain that pattern of behaviour
in
our social kind of environment where you'll be constantly in this sort of... it's constantly in front of you.
It's
like if you live in the sea of donuts, then you'll be eating donuts.
Yeah, which is the whole American problem, isn't it? But we still probably drink too much alcohol in this country.
Definitely.
Yeah. Interesting. So if you're sitting down with a patient and you're talking about lifestyle, how do you even put it to them and what do you say?
Well, I don't tend to talk to people about their lifestyle too much.
Yeah.
Because at that point, when they're seeing me,
I do
touch on not smoking because there is good evidence that shows if you stop smoking even 2 weeks before a major operation, that will reduce your risk of complications. Yeah. So I do have to touch on that.
Yeah.
But at that point, I've got kind of more pressing things that I need to talk about.
Right.
And so I don't do a lot of... lifestyle education as part of my job, unfortunately.
And what if you did? What do you reckon you'd be saying?
Sleep well, eat vegetables, do low intensity exercise, and make some friends and form connections in your community to help you do that.
Yeah, I've always been astonished with that community connection thing. It's like, and we did a study in our group a few years ago. We interviewed about 10,000 New Zealanders.
Mm.
And one of them, there was a set of questions about, do you know your neighbours?
Mm.
Do you talk to them? And, there's questions about that. No, well, the answer is actually no. Compared to some of the European, Scandinavian countries, we were something like...
Really bad.
Wow, we were like...
In urban places particularly.
Yeah, Auckland was the worst. Yeah. Christchurch was the second worst.
I barely know my neighbours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just astonished how low it was. And it was quite highly associated with well-being. So the people who did... felt better about themselves.
Yeah.
We're quite good with families.
Yeah.
We're very good at connecting with our family, but not our neighbours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to make more of an effort with that myself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's worthwhile.
Note to self.
Yeah. All right, Richard, thanks for coming.
Yeah, no, pleasure. Yeah. It's been really nice talking.
And thanks for doing the show.
Yeah.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to the Flippin' Health Podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Precure. Prevention is cure. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. If you know someone who could benefit, please share it with them. Together, we can change medicine for the better. Change medicine for good.